the earliest civilized site on the whole island. An even bigger site, the Ness of Brodgar, is now being excavated too, perhaps giving further substance to such claims. Whichever site claims absolute primacy, collectively, Britain's prehistoric remains make it an immensely rewarding place to visit. All the sites prompt you to consider the literally thousands of years in which men and women tried not just to stay alive, but to elaborate on the bare bones of existence with ritual, decoration, and architectural achievement.
Lecture 3. Roman Britain.
Anyone who loves a mystery is going to enjoy the study of prehistoric Britain, because just about everything there remains mysterious. Once we come to the Roman era, by contrast, we're far better placed to unravel the mysteries and work out the puzzles. That's because the Romans were literate. They commented on what they were doing. We don't simply have Hadrian's Wall, the Roman baths in Bath, and the remains of some opulent villas. We also have discussions of them in official correspondence to and from governors, and the help of dozens of lively writers. We know the names of literally hundreds of Roman Britons, along with the names of the tribal chiefs they displaced during their era of conquest. The downside of visiting Roman Britain is just how fragmentary most of the remains are. Don't expect the Colosseum, Herculaneum, or Pompeii. One of the best historians of Roman buildings, Guy de la Bedoyère, admits that, for the most part, the surviving examples form disappointing chunks of shapeless masonry, and that not a single Romano-British building has survived, even nearly intact, though complete examples are not unknown elsewhere in the former empire. The upside of this situation is that researchers haven't been shy about digging into the scattered remains, because there's not much left above the ground. Bedier points out that excavation reveals the sequence of buildings on a site and shows that the Romans often built over older Bronze and Iron Age buildings. As he says, it has been possible to learn far more about the buildings of Roman Britain than would ever have been possible had they been preserved much better. Julius Caesar visited Britain in 55 and again in 54 BCE in the course of conquering Gaul. He fought against the local tribes there, exacted tribute from some and offered protection to others, but then withdrew. About 90 years later, in AD 43, the Romans returned under the Emperor Claudius and conquered Britain. For Claudius, who'd recently succeeded Caligula, it was a way of gaining the prestige of a successful warrior and strengthening his grip on power. Trade over the preceding centuries had demonstrated that Britain was a prosperous place and a source of valuable copper, iron, and grain. Claudius's army, led by Aulus Plautius, landed at Richborough in Kent, where the remains of a Roman fort can still be visited. The soldiers then fought their way into the island, overcoming tenacious native opposition. Finally, in the year 60, they defeated the army of Boudica, or Boadicea, a mighty female warrior, into whose mouth the author Tacitus put a stirring speech on the pride of warrior queens. Her statue on Westminster Bridge, installed in 1902, has often been used as the symbol of strong female leadership, such as that of Queen Victoria and Margaret Thatcher. Between the years 44 and 410, when the Emperor Honorius withdrew the last troops, most of Britain belonged to the Roman Empire. The only area the Romans didn't subdue was the area they called Caledonia, today's Scotland. Hadrian's Wall, near the current Anglo-Scottish border, is the best-preserved sign of their presence, one of the outstanding places to visit in contemporary Britain. It stretched from coast to coast, 73 miles, from Bowness in the west to the place now aptly named Wall's End in the east. Even today, after nearly two millennia, large parts of it remain. It's nearly disappeared at each end because towns have grown up over its path. And even many of the high central sections have been pilfered through the ages. When you think of the labour required to cut stone with primitive tools into smooth-edged blocks, it's no wonder that later generations cannibalised Hadrian's Wall and other Roman structures. The walls of the crypt at nearby Hexham Abbey still contain many Latin inscriptions, some of them sideways or upside down, betraying the block's origins. Luckily, enough of Hadrian's Wall is left to give us an accurate sense of its shape, size, and purpose. It follows the high ground across the wild Pennine country, maximising visibility for the men who patrolled it. It was about 15 feet high and 8 feet wide, made all the more daunting by the presence of a great ditch on each side, 25 feet wide and 8 feet deep, that would put attackers at a huge disadvantage. You can still see the ditch in places, though there's been a lot of land movement since, and it's nowhere as deep as it was when first built. The fact that these ditches were built on both sides of the wall suggests to historians that the British tribes living south of the wall, the Brigantes, were also regarded by the Romans as a potential threat. The Emperor Hadrian ordered its construction in the early 2nd century, after deciding that the empire need grow no larger. He was there in the year 122 when the work began. It was almost completed in just 6 years. At first, its western section was a great earth and timber rampart, but the whole thing was rebuilt as a much more durable stone structure from coast to coast in the early 3rd century. By order of the Emperor Septimus Severus, at every mile along its course stood a mile castle or miniature fortress with a garrison of about 50 men, castles whose square foundations are still clearly visible. High-quality reconstructions by artists give us a good sense of how they would have looked. At longer intervals stood bigger forts holding 1,000 men each, ready to move quickly to the scene of any threat. It was patrolled mainly by soldiers who came from elsewhere in the empire, from Spain, Gaul and Batavia, present-day Holland, and even from the far eastern reaches of the empire in today's Turkey and Iraq. As with prehistoric Avebury and the Ridgeway in Dorset and Wiltshire, so with Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland and Cumbria. If you possibly can, you should walk at least some of it to get away from the modern roads and recreate for yourself the sensation of being in the wilds of the far north. It is forbidding moorland country. Countless historians have entertained themselves and their readers by imagining soldiers from the Mediterranean lands, even Syria and Persia, finding themselves stationed at this grim, wet extremity of the empire. John Burke, writing in 1983, for example, speaks of the wild background of hills and rock, the steely lofts and the vast sky, and always there is the eerie rustling and moaning of the wind, sometimes rising to a howl like some barbaric battle cry. The first person we know of to walk Hadrian's Wall from end to end was a certain William Hutton in 1801. He came from my hometown, Derby, and didn't attempt the walk until he was already 78 years old. What's more, he walked from the English Midlands to the wall, making a round trip total of more than 600 miles. He doubted his own sanity. And in his book about the experience, The History of the Roman Wall, wrote, "What can exceed the folly of that man who, at 78, walked 600 miles to see a shattered wall?" He also wrote, "Perhaps I am the first man that ever travelled the whole length of this wall, and probably the last that will ever attempt it." I tipped my cap to him when, with my brother Malcolm, I walked just a 4-mile stretch of the wall, there and back, on a day in 2017 that started out misty but ended in bright sunshine. Historians at first assumed that the role of Hadrian's Wall was to stop invading tribes. More recent scholarship has modified the picture, suggesting that the wall should be thought of as a place where trade and tribal movements could be regulated rather than prohibited. It was never designed to be impermeable. Instead, the Romans could keep track of movements back and forth, charge tariffs to traders coming through, but close the gates and reinforce the garrison in times of crisis. Even so, it was breached by attackers on at least three different occasions in the years 197, 296, and 367. Vindolanda, part of Hadrian's Wall, is a grand archaeological site. It was a Roman garrison. A reconstruction of a section of the wall and one of the towers, as they would have been when in use, gives visitors an accurate sense of their height and solidity. Over the last few decades, a long succession of marvellous finds there have rewarded the archaeologists' hard work. The anaerobic or oxygen-free soil has prevented decay of organic materials that would normally have perished centuries ago. Excavations of a rubbish dump created between the years 97 and 103 have brought up leather from shoes, horses' bridles, and even written documents that bring to life the rhythms of everyday life along the wall. Many of these finds are on display at an excellent on-site museum. We know that women as well as men lived in Vindolanda and similar forts. Plenty of their combs and hairpins have been found, and even written notes, shopping lists, and a birthday invitation from one lady to another. To date, the site has yielded up about 400 such notes, which are collectively known as the Vindolanda Tablets. Most of the notes are preserved in the British Museum, and were recently voted Britain's most popular archaeological discovery. But a selection of them are also on view at the Vindolanda Museum itself. These written notes were made not on paper, but on very thin pieces of wood, usually birch or alder bark, hardly thicker than cardboard. The usual method was to write the message in ink, then fold the bark sheet in half, writing the name of the intended recipient on the outside. Archaeologists have found that it's possible, by carefully unfolding the tablets and shining infrared light on them, to read the handwriting. At first, experts in Latin epigraphy were baffled by it. It is a previously unfamiliar style of cursive script. Most of them are lists of items needed by the garrison. One of them shows that Roman soldiers did wear underpants. In another note, a soldier named Masculus writes to his commander Cerealis, saying there is no beer, and asking him to send for more. The soldier's diet was based on grain baked into bread, but a wide variety of foodstuffs are mentioned in the tablets, including olives and wine, which must have been imported from southern Europe, and even pepper. The Vindolanda tablets also make it clear that the soldiers were jacks of all trades. Many of them worked at building and maintaining the wall itself. Others were shoemakers, wagoners, brewers, and armourers. Fortunes could be made in supplying the garrisons, too. One letter detailing the various business activities of two energetic brothers, Octavius and Candidus, includes the following passage. "Make sure that you send me some cash, so that I may have ears of grain on the threshing room floor. I have already finished threshing all that I had. A messmate of our friend Frontius has been here. He wanted me to allocate him some hides, and that being so, was ready to give cash. I told him I would give him the hides by the calends of March. He decided he would come on the Ides of January. He did not turn up, nor did he take the trouble to obtain them, since he had hides. If he'd given the cash, I would have given him them. I hear that Frontinius Julius has for sale, at a high price, the leatherware which he bought here for 5 denarii apiece." Well, as you can see from these excerpts, there's nothing elevated or literary in the Vindolanda tablets. There's no hint here of Cicero or Tacitus. The very ordinariness of them is what makes them precious to historians, of course, bringing the details to light of how massive forces thousands of miles from Rome were kept fit, well supplied, and in fighting order. They're the nuts and bolts of a big bureaucracy in action. Another fort along Hadrian's Wall at Chester's was excavated in the early 19th century by the local landowner, John Clayton, who realized the historical importance of his estates. His house stood at the point where the wall crossed the River Tyne. To guard the crossing, the Romans built a fortress, that were staffed for a century by Spanish cavalrymen. Chester's includes the remains of the soldiers' barracks, the commander's home, and the strong room in which the garrison's funds would be kept. The strong room still has its original roof, one of very few such places in Britain. The remains of the bathhouse are visible, including the changing room that contains the niches in which visitors would leave their clothes, and the well-preserved sudatorium, or sweating room. After excavating Chester's itself, Clayton went on to acquire several other fortresses and to buy lands that included lengths of the wall. It's in large part due to him that so much of Hadrian's Wall still exists. The artist William Bell Scott's romantic painting, "The Romans Cause a Wall to be Built," is dominated by a centurion whose face is modelled on Clayton's own. Clayton himself gathered together hundreds of stones bearing inscriptions and other items of interest that his workmen turned up. A museum at Chester's was built in 1895 to house the whole lot, and it presents a crowded, jumbled appearance. Curators recently made the decision to leave it like that rather than rearrange it according to contemporary museological standards. They repainted the interior with bright red paint, aiming to duplicate its appearance in the first decade of the 20th century. This is a super idea, I think, giving visitors today the chance to see a kind of double museum, which draws your attention not only to the Roman objects, but also to the history of thinking about history. At another museum, Arbeia, in South Shields, on the east coast, part of a Roman fortress has been reconstructed. The replica includes a Roman gateway, which provides a sense of the fort's original scale and grandeur. The original structure would have served as a crucial link in the defence of the northern frontier. It was the port to which food and military supplies were shipped from southern England or continental Europe, and from which they were sent to garrisons along the wall. Among the best items in the Arbeia Museum are monuments recalling the lives of two Britons who began life as slaves and were freed. One of them, Regina, married a merchant originally from Palmyra in modern-day Syria, whose grave also stands nearby and provides further evidence of the variety of people who ended up in the north of Britannia. The name Arbeia may signify place of the Arabs, a reference to the fact that the first soldiers there had previously been stationed on the Tigris River in present-day Iraq. Under Hadrian's successor, Antoninus Pius, in the year 142, the Romans advanced 100 miles further into Scotland and built a second wall, the Antonine Wall, at the narrowest crossing point of Scotland from west to east, about 39 miles. An earth and timber rampart on stone foundations, it took 12 years to complete. Less of it remains than of Hadrian's Wall, partly because it was not built of stone, and partly because the outskirts of two great cities have overrun it, Edinburgh to the east and Glasgow to the west. But several sections in the centre have been preserved and can still be visited. Slabs carved by the soldiers who did the hard work on the wall read like this: "For the Emperor Caesar Titus Aelius Hadriano Antoninus Augustus, father of his country, a detachment of the 6th Legion Victrix Pia Fidelis built the rampart for 3,240 feet. The Antonine Wall fell into disuse in the later 2nd century, was briefly reoccupied in the early 200s, but then abandoned once and for all, apparently because the Caledonians were just too difficult to subdue. Along with Hadrian's Wall, the second great site of Roman Britain still visible and with lots to see is the Roman Baths at the city of Bath in the southwest. It is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The Romans called it Aquae Sulis. Sulphurous hot springs there, even though they smell and taste horrible, have long been taken to have healing properties. We know from research on recovered Roman-era skeletons that arthritis and rheumatism were common ailments, which the waters were supposed to soothe. This was the basis of the town's growth. The name Aquae Sulis derives from Sulis, a local Celtic goddess, and the springs were already sacred to the people who lived in the area before the Romans arrived. The Romans had a tolerant approach to the religions of the people they dominated, often blending their own gods with those they found locally. So it's not surprising that the Romans dedicated the baths jointly to Sulis and Minerva, the Roman goddess of healing. An extensive and well-curated tour at Bath takes you through the main Roman sections, including the spring itself, running hot, just as it did 2,000 years ago, the swimming pool, the temple, and a museum containing the best finds from the site. Generations of modification, especially from the late 1800s, sometimes require you to work out what's original and what's a later addition. But the mood of the place is still ancient, highly addictive. Roman visitors threw coins and bracelets into the waters to propitiate the gods. The best of them are on display. Among the finds was a cursed tablet written backwards, asking the goddess to destroy the people who had stolen away a woman named Vilbia, and even naming a few of them. Baths were a central element of daily life for the Romans. Villas often had private baths of their own, but nearly all the major Roman cities included large public baths, to which even relatively poor people had access. They were centres of social life and exercise, as well as cleanliness, and were ingeniously provided with underfloor heating and pools of various temperatures, the cold frigidarium, the warm tepidarium, and the hot caldarium, along with sweating chambers and massage rooms. Many were lavishly decorated with mosaic floors, and were so well built that they're among the most durable of Roman remains. Bath itself, supplied by a hot spring, is slightly different, and one of only a handful of Roman baths in which it was actually possible to swim rather than merely soak. There was a similar arrangement at two other Roman sites we know of, Buxton in Derbyshire and Roxter in Shropshire. The main pool at Bath, like the water pipes supplying it, was clad with lead sheeting and about 6 feet deep. Bathers stepped down into it to immerse themselves in water that flowed in at 115 degrees Fahrenheit, or 46 centigrade. Evidence of the Roman presence is scattered throughout Britain, though more in England than in Wales or Scotland, where the Roman presence was more temporary. Villas, all in various states of ruin, are among the best of them. Some indicate that members of the British elite switched the style of their houses from circular wood and thatch houses to rectangular stone buildings in the Roman era. Chedworth, in the Cotswolds of Gloucestershire, is an extensive site and well worth a visit. Built between the 2nd and 4th centuries, it must have been the home of a wealthy family, though we don't know whether they were Romans or Romanized Britons. The villa was discovered by accident in 1864 by a gamekeeper when his hunting dogs rooted up a few mosaic tiles. They were on the land of the Earl of Eldon. The Earl's uncle, James Farrar, an enthusiastic antiquarian, excavated it over the next few years. It features well-preserved mosaic floors and enough of the walls to give you a sense of how magnificent it must once have been. It had underfloor heating too. A spring providing fresh water to the villa is also preserved. Its elaborate stonework shows it to have been a shrine, not just a well. On summer weekends, local craftsmen at Chedworth demonstrate how the Romans wove, made arrows, smelted iron, and other practical trades. The building dominating Chedworth, ironically, is a Victorian house built by the first excavators as a museum for their finds, an outrageous intrusion by today's archaeological standards. Another villa at Woodchester, also in Gloucestershire, was excavated in 1793 by Samuel Lysons, a local enthusiast. There was nothing visible above ground, but he dug down to disclose a magnificent mosaic more than 2,000 square feet in area, which made it one of the biggest and best-preserved Roman mosaics still in existence. Its central figure is Orpheus, playing his lyre. Tantalizingly, it's not currently on view. The last time it was shown was in 1973. So many people came to see it, 141,000 in 50 days, that the village was jammed with traffic. The local people decided it was more trouble than it was worth and voted to cover it up again and it's been buried ever since. At least we have good photographs of it, along with a replica containing 1.5 million mosaic pieces made by two local craftsmen. For a while, the replica was on display in a local abbey, but it was auctioned off in 2010 and is also now unavailable. There's something very English about this story. It's a great illustration of the fact that one man's priceless treasure is another man's pain in the neck. The fact that the situation remains like this is also testimony to just how many other Roman remains are available to visit as alternatives. The best Roman site in Wales is the amphitheatre at Caerleon, just north of Newport. The Romans had a fort there, which they called Isca Augusta. And besides the amphitheatre, the barracks and bathhouse of Isca Augusta are also visible in outline. As for the amphitheatre itself, it is oval in shape, with 8 great entrances. Prior to the 20th century, it was known to the local folk as King Arthur's Round Table. But excavations in 1926 confirmed its Roman origins. It was built about AD 80 for audiences of up to 6,000 and was twice rebuilt during the occupation. Only in imagination, alas, can you see it as a distinguished provincial variant of the Colosseum in Rome. The highest still-standing Roman building in Britain, incidentally, is the shell of a lighthouse at Dover Castle. It's a great, thick, lumpy cylinder right next to a church, originally Anglo-Saxon, that has been extensively renovated and modernised. Its location is matchless on one of the highest points of the fort, overlooking the English Channel. One way you sometimes become aware of the Roman mark on Britain is by driving on long, straight roads. Everywhere they went, the Romans built good roads to ensure rapid and effective military communications. They usually went straight over hills rather than contouring around them, ignoring older pathways that were more roundabout. The greatest of the Roman roads are the Fosse Way, marking a very straight line between Bath and Lincoln, Ermine Street from London to York, and Watling Street, a Roman adaptation of an even earlier road that made a continuous line between Richborough in Kent, across the Thames, and onto Roxter near the Welsh border. Replacing old dirt tracks that became impassable in wet weather, the Romans built elevated roadways paved with crushed rock or occasionally dressed stone, and built drainage ditches on each side to keep the roads themselves free from swamping. About every 4 miles would be a staging post so that dispatch riders with urgent messages could change horses regularly and maintain a high speed. These roads were so good and so superior to anything else that they were used continually for centuries after the Romans left in 410. And in places they became the basis for the national road system right up to the present. Very few stretches of unchanged Roman road are still visible. One is Wade's Causeway on high moorland in the North York Moors National Park. It has a high-quality surface made from sandstone slabs closely fitted together, is elevated, and has the characteristic drainage ditches on each side. I walked a mile of it recently, felt very Roman, and only discovered afterwards that there are now some academic doubts about its provenance. It's not quite straight enough, say the doubters, and might be from a later era. Perhaps the slight deviations from straight are due to subsequent earth movements over the centuries. We have no hard evidence, but Wade's Causeway is certainly built in the same general style as Roman roads and gives you an inkling of how the roads must have looked as the legions marched along them. This survey of Roman remains in Britain is not comprehensive. To include everything would turn it into a mere list. St Albans near London and Chester near Liverpool also have significant Roman remains, and nearly all important historical sites in southern Britain contain Roman traces. These traces may not be as impressive as the Colosseum or the Pantheon in Rome, but they are important reminders of a presence that shaped the course of Western history. To be in almost any place of continuous habitation in Britain is to be in one of the places the Romans lived, worked, fought, and prayed together during their nearly 400 years of occupation.
Lecture 4, Anglo-Saxon and Viking Britain.
In the last days of Roman Britain, Germanic tribes began to migrate to England across the North Sea. The power vacuum that followed the Romans' evacuation of Britain in 410 accelerated this migration. From Jutland in present-day Denmark came the Jutes, while from present-day northern Germany came the Angles and the Saxons. The name England means land of the Angles. Say Angleland rapidly a few times and you'll get England. The Edict of Thessalonica of 380 mandated Christianity as the Roman Empire's official religion. Roman remains in Britain indicate the popularity of Mithraism, a form of sun worship, but there are also scattered vestiges of Roman Christianity. The Anglo-Saxons were pagans, but between the 5th and the 8th centuries, they too gradually adopted Christianity. The best book describing this process is the Venerable Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People, from the year 731. Bede himself, sometimes referred to as the father of English history, was a monk at Jarrow, near Newcastle-upon-Tyne. The chancel of the Anglo-Saxon church at Jarrow, St. Paul's, where he worshipped, is still well preserved, and a few fragments of 8th century stained glass discovered nearby have been integrated into the church windows. Standing in the chancel, it's therefore possible to experience the same light through the same glass between the same walls as Bede himself. His history is a guide to the Anglo-Saxon kings, their wars, their holy men and women, and the gradual spread of Christianity. Its heroes are the saintly monks and nuns who preached Christianity, and the kings who accepted it and lived by its principles. Its villains are the stubborn warriors who refused to convert or who slipped back into paganism. Of King Oswald of Northumberland, for example, Bede writes, "Oswald, the most Christian king of the Northumbrians, reigned for 9 years, if we include the fatal year made abhorrent by the callous impiety of the British King Cadwalla and the insane apostasy of the English kings Osric and Eanfrid. For it has been generally agreed that the names of these apostates should be erased from the list of Christian kings and the year of their reign ignored." He goes on to say that after good King Oswald's death in battle, so many people took dust from the ground where he had fallen that, as the earth was gradually moved, a pit was left in which a man could stand. No wonder this dust had miraculous healing powers. Bede's writings, when combined with archaeological research, enable us to reconstruct many aspects of Anglo-Saxon British history in detail. On the other hand, the material remains fragmentary and ambiguous. For much of the period between the 5th and 9th centuries, Anglo-Saxon England was divided into 7 kingdoms, which are known to historians as the Heptarchy. Northumbria was the most northerly of these kingdoms, while the middle of England was the Kingdom of Mercia. East Anglia, as its name suggests, was the land of the Eastern Angles. Sussex and Essex, which have survived into recent times as county names, are the lands of the southern and eastern Saxons, while Wessex was the land of the western Saxons. In the southeast of England was Kent. The kings of these 7 territories were chronically at war with one another, as each strove to become Bretwalda, the dominant king or Briton ruler. Religious division accompanied this political division. Christianity introduced from Scotland and Ireland differed in several ways from the Christianity brought from Rome. One of the great set pieces of Bede's ecclesiastical history is his account of the Synod of Whitby, a 7th century meeting that tried to reconcile these differences. Bede was not there himself, he was born just a few years after the synod, but he knew several monks who did attend, and historians think his account is fairly reliable. King Oswy of Northumbria oversaw the synod, which decided that the Roman way of selecting the date of Easter each year should prevail, and that Northumbrian monks should have the same tonsure, the distinctive monastic haircut, as those further south. Whitby itself, seen of the synod, is one of the most attractive little coastal towns in the whole of Britain. Now a fishing village and vacation spot, it was historically a major monastic foundation of both monks and nuns. The splendid ruins of the abbey overlook the whole town in one direction and the North Sea in another. Admittedly, they're the ruins of an abbey that was built centuries after the synod, but still, the actual location is the same. It has a haunted aspect. A dramatic stone staircase leads you from the remains of the abbey down to the port itself. The biggest and most visible Anglo-Saxon object in Britain is Offa's Dyke. Offa was king of Mercia from the mid-750s to 796, who built a continuous barrier on his western frontier, probably as a guard against Welsh raiders. It was a ditch or trench on the Welsh side, with the displaced earth thrown up to a rampart on the Mercian side. Its existence is testimony to the organisational powers of Mercian kings, who presumably used conscripted labour to get such a massive project finished. As two recent historians wrote, "The dyke must have been a powerful ideological statement, inviting comparisons between Offa and Roman rulers of the past, who'd undertaken similarly grand construction projects, the Hadrianic and Antonine Walls being the most obvious examples." Radiocarbon dating has found evidence that some parts of the dyke are earlier, so Offa may have completed a job already partly done by his predecessors. Crossing land, most of which is still farmed, it fades from view in places, but is still distinct in others. The best place to visit it is at Knighton, where an Offa's Dyke visitor centre explains its significance, and where well-preserved sections are visible. Since 1971, hikers have also been able to walk Offa's Dyke Path, a national trail that runs for 177 miles along the Anglo-Welsh border. In addition to earthworks, several English churches survive from the 7th, 8th and 9th centuries. Probably the least altered is tiny St. Lawrence's Church at Bradford-on-Avon in Wiltshire. Only in the 19th century was its significance recognised as one of the very few 8th century buildings that had not been modified over the following generations. Equally well kept is the chapel of St. Peter on the Wall in Bradwell-on-Sea in Essex. Built even earlier, around 660, it recycled Roman bricks and cut stones. Standing half a mile from the nearest road, a simple barn-like box, its quiet rural setting makes it magically evocative of antiquity. A third and much bigger example is All Saints Church in Brixworth, Northamptonshire. It too is largely unchanged since its construction in the 680s. Only the tower and spire are subsequent additions. Let me just pause at this point to explain one of the traditions about place names in Britain, such as Bradford-on-Avon or Bradwell-on-Sea. There are several places called Bradford, so the addition of on Avon is a way of distinguishing which one is being discussed. The Avon is a river. Stoke-on-Trent and Newcastle-upon-Tyne are similar examples, identifying the rivers Trent and Tyne. Of course, in the days before there were railways or good roads, rivers were the principal means of transport, so they were the obvious items to mention in identifying a town. Carved crosses from the Anglo-Saxon period are also widespread in England. They're usually much worn by centuries of weathering. Probably the best is the 7th or 8th century Rothwell Cross, now protected from the elements inside Rothwell Parish Church, just north of the Scottish border. It was smashed by iconoclastic Presbyterians in the 1640s, but the fragments lying around the graveyard were reassembled by a 19th century vicar. An indoor apse was purpose-built for it in 1887. It is 18 feet high and includes elaborate carvings of Jesus, along with poetry in both Latin and runic. A similar cross at Bewcastle in Cumbria appears to come from the same era, and possibly even the same craftsman. Unfortunately, its head is missing. It too has elaborate carvings, featuring vines and mythical beasts, birds and saints, and might once have been part of Jarrow Monastery, where the Venerable Bede lived and worked. A third Saxon cross, the Easby Cross, is now kept in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. In the 20th and 21st centuries, archaeologists have been excited by major Anglo-Saxon finds. The most spectacular was the Sutton Hoo ship burial in East Anglia, east of Ipswich. In 1937, the local landowner, a widow and spiritualist named Edith Pretty, thought that she'd seen a ghost from her upstairs window. Deciding to excavate the numerous oddly shaped mounds on her property, and speculating that the ghost might be linked to them, she hired a self-taught archaeologist named Basil Brown. He uncovered a wonderful Anglo-Saxon ship burial. Mrs. Pretty's gardener and a local gamekeeper also joined in the painstaking work of uncovering the whole thing. When archaeologists from Cambridge University and the British Museum realised the significance of the discovery, they took over the work in 1939 amid squabbles and personality clashes. John Preston's 2007 novel, The Dig, uses the real names and creates a fine dramatisation of these events. Before the excavations could be completed, World War II began, so the site was not fully explored until the 1960s. The timbers of the Sutton Hoo ship had rotted away over the centuries, but its impression, or ghost, was clearly shown by the excavators. This had been a real seagoing ship with places for 40 oarsmen and evidence of periodic repairs. Its benches and mast had been removed, and a central area enclosed to receive the body. The ship had then been dragged up out of the river, lowered into an excavated chamber, and, after the interment, probably of King Raedwald of East Anglia, a great mound heaped up over it. Luckily, earlier treasure hunters and grave robbers had failed to get at the heart of the burial. Treasures from inside the ship, surrounding the body, came not just from East Anglia, but from many parts of Britain and Europe, one item from as far away as Byzantium. They bear witness to the complex trade patterns of the 7th century, despite the political fragmentation of post-Roman Europe. A warrior helmet was perhaps the most impressive find. It has a full face mask, highly decorated, cheek flaps, and a neck protector. The royal armour is made a superb replica, and it exudes an ancient ferocity. Other objects found at the site include buckles, belts, clasps, dishes and spoons, and a decorated shield with minutely detailed engraving and brightly coloured enamels. A coroner's inquest awarded all the discoveries to Mrs. Pretty. In England, the coroner is an agent of the Crown. She was generous enough to donate them all to the nation. There are 17 other mounds at Sutton Hoo, though most have eroded over the centuries, some to the point of near invisibility. Mound 2, also a ship mound, was restored to its probable original height and shape in 1992 as a way of testing erosion rates. In Mound 17, archaeologists found another undisturbed grave. This was a young man buried along with his horse and a cluster of personal items, including a hair comb made of bone. Most of the items from Sutton Hoo were carried off to the British Museum, where they're still on display. A museum at Sutton Hoo itself contains excellent descriptions and photographs of the mounds, the history of the excavation, and high-quality replicas of the finds. This is the place to see them on site. In London, though well cared for, the originals feel out of context, and they have to contend with the vestiges of other mighty cultures. Sutton Hoo is a great story about uncovering buried treasure. Recent developments in metal detection have led to new discoveries. In the year 2009, for example, near the village of Hammerwich in Staffordshire, An Anglo-Saxon treasure hoard was discovered by Terry Herbert, a metal detector enthusiast working in a recently ploughed field. He filled 244 bags with his finds before contacting the relevant authorities to announce this discovery. The farmer, Fred Johnson, then permitted qualified archaeologists to undertake a systematic survey and excavation of his field. In all, there are around 4,000 objects, making it the biggest hoard ever collected from one site. Most of the objects come from the 7th century, and nearly all are military, including sword hilts, buckles, and knife handles. But they don't appear to be connected to a burial, and this is not a battlefield. It's almost as though their owner, worried for their safety, dug a hole for them, marked it, but was never able to return and recover his stash. Some of the garnets might have come from as far away as Sri Lanka. I saw some of the items Herbert had found at the City of Birmingham Museum, mainly gold fragments, garnets, and brooches. What impressed me about them were their brightness, many of them are brilliantly enameled, and the extremely sophisticated and detailed decoration. Several of the items were shown under magnifying glasses to give visitors the chance to see their full intricacy. Other parts of the hoard are on display at Stoke-on-Trent, Tamworth, and with a touring exhibition. In the 790s, Britain endured another round of invasions. This time, the intruders were from Scandinavia, the Vikings. They didn't have helmets with horns. That's a Victorian invention from the 1870s. But they were warlike and ruthless. The word Viking means raiding, and is sometimes used as a verb rather than as the name for a group of people. In British history, they're usually called the Danes. They had magnificent names. One of the first major Viking kings was Harald Fairhair. His son was Eric Bloodaxe. In the first paragraph of one of the Icelandic sagas, which are great sources for understanding Viking history, we meet Ketil Flatnose, Eystein the Rattler, Thorfinn the Skullcleaver, Thorbjorg the Ship-breasted, and Eyhof the Foul. Viking names have two elements. One is nicknames like Skullcleaver and Ship-breasted, while the other corresponds to the individual's father's name. Hence, the son of Eric the Red was Leif Erik's son, and his daughter was Freydis Eriksdottir. The Vikings' first appearance in Britain was their attack on the island monastery at Lindisfarne, or Holy Island, off the northeastern coast. Here's how the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle describes what happened. AD 793. This year came dreadful forewarnings over the land of the Northumbrians, terrifying the people most woefully. There were immense sheets of light rushing through the air, and whirlwinds, and fiery dragons flying across the firmament. These tremendous tokens were soon followed by a great famine, and not long after, on the sixth day before the Ides of January in the same year, the harrowing inroads of heathen men made lamentable havoc in the Church of God in Holy Island by rapine and slaughter. It was the first of many ruthless attacks on eastern England. The raiders seized everything of value, killed the poor men, carried the women off into slavery, and took the richest men for ransom. The shock was profound. After several centuries of relative peace, at least for the church, suddenly everything seemed vulnerable. Lindisfarne, site of the attack, is today one of the most enchanting places in England. Just a few miles south of the Scottish border, it's only accessible when the tide is low. The Venerable Bede described it like this. As the tide ebbs and flows, this place is surrounded by sea twice a day, like an island, and twice a day the sand dries and joins it to the mainland. Today you must follow a winding road to get to the causeway, read the tide tables carefully, and drive slowly across to the island, after which you need to keep in mind throughout your visit just how much time is left before the waters close over the road. Otherwise, you'll be stuck. As with most English monasteries, the site of the Viking raid is now just a ruin, albeit a very picturesque one. It had been founded by Saint Aidan, an Irish Christian and evangelist, in the 630s, 150 years earlier. There's now a modern statue of him on site, necessarily speculative, because we have no idea what he actually looked like. The monastery had also been the home of St. Cuthbert. Alcuin of York, a learned monk who lived nearby, wrote, "Lo, it is nearly 350 years that we and our fathers have inhabited this most lovely land, and never before has such terror appeared in Britain as we have now suffered from a pagan race. Nor was it thought that such an inroad from the sea could be made. Behold the church of St. Cuthbert, spattered with the blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments, a place more venerable than all in Britain, is given as a prey to pagan peoples." A biography of Cuthbert, written at Lindisfarne, is the oldest work of history in England to have survived. The Vikings must have been delighted to find such a rich target, so close to the shore, undefended. Lindisfarne is also the site of a superb castle on a vertical rock that dominates the island. Built in the 1500s, because of the chronic problem of Scottish raids, it was allowed to fall into ruin, but was restored and rebuilt in the early 20th century by the architect Edwin Lutyens. It's not big inside, especially by comparison with nearby Bamburgh, but there can't be more than a dozen buildings in the world that provoke such an instant emotional reaction. It's England's answer to Mont Saint-Michel in France, another great building on top of a striking, isolated rock. After the initial raid on Lindisfarne, Viking depredations became a regular fact of life in the early 800s, especially along the east coast of England. The Vikings were still pagans. Their three main gods were Odin, Thor, and Frey, after whom we name Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Odin was the one-eyed god of wisdom and guile. Thor was the god of thunder and war. Frey was the god of fertility, farming, and sex. Viking ships were the best in the world at that time, combining the capacity to sail long distances out of sight of land with a shallow draft that enabled them to sail far up England's rivers and attack inland communities. A combination of sails and oars also made them manoeuvrable in a wide variety of conditions. The Norwegian counterpart of Sutton Hoo is the Gokstad ship, discovered near Oslo in 1880. A replica built in 1893, the Viking, made an Atlantic crossing, which confirmed the plausibility of the story that Leif Erikson had been the first European to visit the Americas around the year 1000. For the first time in 865, an actual Viking army landed in East Anglia, intent not just on raiding, but on conquering Anglo-Saxon Britain. It was led by the unforgettably named Ivar the Boneless, and is remembered in English history as the Great Heathen Army. It marched north, sacked Whitby, captured York, and seemed all set to dominate the whole of Britain. Opposition came from the kings of Wessex, Ethelred, and then his brother Alfred the Great, who ruled from 871 until 899. Alfred is the only English king ever to be called the Great. His achievement was to prevent Viking conquest of the whole country. At one point, he was forced into hiding in the marshlands of Athelney, Somerset, where a monument to him still stands. Seeking shelter with an old peasant woman, according to legend, she asked him to keep an eye on the cakes she was baking. Preoccupied by his precarious military situation, he forgot. The cakes got burned, and the woman berated him, only to discover moments later that she was boxing the ears of her king. Archaeological work at Athelney has shown that this was the site of an Iron Age fort, that Athelney was an island, often surrounded by flooded fields, and that a causeway led from it to nearby East Lyng. Signs of metalworking in the area also suggest that Alfred and his followers cast weapons there in preparation for their counterattack on the Vikings. Another legend has Alfred cleverly disguised as a minstrel, spying on the Viking camp. Whatever the merits of the legend, it is true that his army won a decisive victory against the Viking general Guthrum at Edington in 878. Guthrum was forced to become a Christian, with Alfred acting as his godfather. England was partitioned into a Viking-dominated East known as the Danelaw and an Anglo-Saxon-dominated West under Alfred. G.K. Chesterton's epic poem, The Ballad of the White Horse, tells the whole story in verse as a triumph of Christianity over paganism. The traditional site of the battle is Egbert's Stone, an unobtrusive marker. At Stourhead nearby, however, commanding the surrounding country, is King Alfred's Tower, a striking triangular tower completed in 1772 to celebrate England's victory over France in the Seven Years' War, or as Americans call it, the French and Indian War. It's 160 feet high and includes a statue of King Alfred and an inscription that reads, Alfred the Great, AD 879, on this summit erected his standard against Danish invaders. To him we owe the origin of juries, the establishment of a militia, the creation of a naval force. Alfred, the light of a benighted age, was a philosopher and a Christian, the father of his people, the founder of the English monarchy and liberty. There are also statues of Alfred in Wantage in Oxfordshire, Pewsey in Wiltshire and Winchester, all from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In the centuries after Alfred's reign, the various populations of England gradually merged through coexistence, intermarriage and trade. Anglo-Saxon and Viking artistic traditions also persisted and interacted with those of the Normans after 1066. Look at the church doorway of Kilpeck in Herefordshire near the Welsh border, built in about 1140. Norman themes predominate, but there's an elaborate and playful set of Anglo-Saxon beasts and abstract patterns around the south door, including dragons swallowing their own tails. One of the best archaeological finds from Viking England is a treasure hoard found in 1840 in Cuerdale in Lancashire. Workmen were strengthening the embankment on the River Ribble when they unearthed a box containing 88 pounds of coins, bracelets and decorated chains, mostly made of silver. Some of the coins were from the Danelaw, some from Wessex and some from remote parts of Europe. The workmen were given one coin each and the rest passed to the crown. They're displayed partly in the British Museum and partly in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. No one knows who buried this treasure or why, but a probable date seems to be around the year 910. More recently, metal detector enthusiasts have been improving our understanding of the Vikings as well as the Anglo-Saxons. In 2007, for example, a metal detectorist named David Whelan and his son Andrew found a hoard of about 600 coins and other items near Harrogate in Yorkshire. They are enclosed in a decaying lead case and stored inside a highly decorated silver and gold pot. Similarly, in 2011, a hobbyist named Darren Webster located the Silverdale hoard in Lancashire with his metal detector. Both these hoards included items that appear to have been made nearby, along with items from present-day Turkey and Uzbekistan, as well as many other European centres. The British Treasure Act of 1996 says that if you find anything over 300 years old, you have to report it to the authorities, and that a coroner will then decide who gets it. Usually the landowner and the finder share it, while museums compete to buy the finds. For example, the Harrogate hoard was valued at over £1 million and was purchased jointly by the British Museum and the York Museums Trust. That meant quite a payout for David and Andrew Whelan. There's a love-hate relationship between the archaeologists and the metal detectorists. Any man with a metal detector who suddenly encounters a pot of gold is likely to see himself as the rightful possessor. Pots of gold in the ground and sudden vaults from poverty to wealth have long been staples of folklore and daydreams. Archaeologists, by contrast, want the metal detectorists to stop the instant they see the glint of ancient metal, to alert the authorities and then to just go away. The BBC ran a comedy TV show, Detectorists, in 2014, making fun of hobbyists' delusions of grandeur. But the issues are serious. Metal detectors